History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to, as long as we're willing to take a couple pretty simple steps. First, take that initiative to ask a few questions. And second, invest a little time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these descriptions of situations none of us will ever find ourselves in. Very few of us, anyway, and I know inspiration's on the docket today with an incredible rescue story that can become a little more than a story for you if you happen to be at the right place at the right time. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard a lot about the Honor Flight program, flying veterans free of charge to their memorials in Washington, D.C. And now that we've reached September, Honor Flights are revving their engines up again, and there's a good chance that wherever you're listening, there's an honor flight taking off there in your backyard soon. They're always looking for new volunteers to help support the mission, and even if you don't do that, just showing up to welcome a plane full of veterans back home is a pretty powerful experience. Take my word for it. I get goosebumps every single time. The Navy Cross recipient you're going to hear from today will be on his honor flight this next week, and maybe you'll have the chance to cheer him on. You can always find an honor flight hub in your area at honorflight.org, and just for example, if you're one of our listeners in the state of Washington, in Spokane or Tri-Cities on KSBN or KONA, Inland Northwest Honor Flight will send another group of veterans to D.C. on October 9th. A little further south in Oregon for our KYKN listeners in Salem, South Willamette Valley Honor Flight will take off September 28th. That group's even started a new podcast with the veterans that they take. It's called Valor Vault. You should check it out. I know we have some new listeners in Tennessee and Virginia on WABN, and Honor Flight of the Appalachian Highlands is getting ready for its fifth mission on September 22nd. In the Golden State, there are upcoming flights in the Bay Area, from the Central Coast, Bakersfield, and from the only airport in America with giant sequoia replicas towering in the terminal, Fresno Yosemite International. If you're there on September 13th to welcome home the latest mission of Central Valley Honor Flight, one of the decorated veterans you'll be cheering on has lived the half century with gratitude that he and his crew survived a very different kind of flight, an incredible rescue mission into North Vietnam that earned him that Navy Cross. Harry Zinser is 77 now and battling Parkinson's disease. You may hear that reflected in his voice a little. Back then, he was just 26 and only a few years removed from starring on the gridiron at Wheaton College in Illinois. Harry was the pilot of an HH-3A search and rescue helicopter aboard the aircraft carrier USS Saratoga with Helicopter Support Squadron 7.
I usually stayed up a little bit later, and I was the last one to go to Iraq, so before I retired for the evening, I went into CIC, this Combat Information Center. She says, hey, Lieutenant, let's go over here. Says, they're getting ready to launch one of your big mothers overland, to go overland for a rescue overland. I go, what? He says, yeah, South SAR, 2 miles to the south of us. We had a helicopter on board there. They're ready to launch them. And I says, Chief, that'll never happen. He says, we don't go overland. He says, yeah, they're getting ready to launch them overland. And the radios crackled. And we heard him say, Red Crown, that's call sign for South SAR. Said, Red Crown. He says, yeah, have you launched your big mother yet? I said, no, semi. Then they came back later, about a minute later. This is Red Crown. Says, our big mother's down. We heard a radio call. Says, break, break. Says, Oslo, this is Jehovah. Launch your big mother now. Jehovah's call sign for the Admiral when he spoke on the radio. We have people who have been through the entire Vietnam War. They never heard Jehovah on the radios. We heard him twice that night. First time was when he told the Red Crown to launch your big mother. She says, what? Yeah, it's the adjutant, Chief. I call your skipper. I said, emergency flight course, we have to launch. He says, I can't call my skipper. I says, why can't you call your skipper? He says, well, it's just orders not to bother the skipper at night. He says, you got to call him tonight, or I tell you, you won't have a job tomorrow. And I think I was right, because they called emergency flight course, and the CO was at the helm when we took off. I know he was. So I was the first one out to the helo. Had a flashlight with me. I pre-fired the helicopter. So I took the engine covers off. I got in the center seat, and I had number went in and started by the time my cobot got out there. So he says, what's up? I says, hey, we're launching. Now, back then, when you took off from a non-aviation ship, you could not land on it at night. We did not have night vision goggles back then at all. We could take off from a non-aviation ship, but we could not land. So I knew we were going to head back. I knew we'd be landing in the Midway, 200 miles away. We had 3 hours of gas on board. We fly 100 miles, about 100 knots. It took 2 hours to get to the carrier. But we had to stay low because we were up in Haiphong Harbor, and we had to fly below the radar. So we're about 10 miles off the shore. So we're flying at 500 feet. We have radio comms with the ship for about 30 miles. So we flew about another 40 miles before we had comms again. So I briefed our crew and said, what's up? I said, crew, the A-7 pilot has been shot down over North Vietnam. They want to launch our big mother to the south, but they're down, so they're launching us. So what are they launching us for? So I don't know. So we launched, and we're now the primary search and rescue vehicle. And I briefed them that he had been shut down about 2 hours ago. They had not heard from him. They had to come up on voice in order for rescue to be made. We knew the area where he was shot down, heavily fortified with the North Vietnamese Army, and so we thought he had been captured. But come to find out, he had not been captured. He's a pretty savvy guy himself. First of all, he got hit by a SAM missile. Surface-air missile. He saw one coming on his radar. He avoided it, but he got hit by another special one that he did not see. Usually what happens. He was going through 2,000 feet uncontrolled when he bailed out. Minimum uncontrollable safe bailout altitude, as I was told later, is about 10,000 feet for an A-7.
So the minimum safe altitude to bail out of an A-7 is 10,000 feet. If you're bailing out less than that, there's no guarantee that you're going to survive this. And you said he was only at 2,000 feet?
He was only 2,000 feet when he bailed out.
So the odds were not in his favor?
Not at all. Uh-huh. He said he got about two swings in his shooting, he was on the ground. He said he landed right next to his aircraft, which was a ball of fire.
We'll get back to Harry Zinsser's account shortly, but if we're going to talk about that downed pilot, why not talk to that downed pilot, Jim Lloyd?
By the time we went, we call feet dry into North Vietnam, it was dark. We got up to the area. The anti-aircraft fire was spotty, and I thought this is going to be a piece of cake. We'll be done in an hour and get back to the ship and watch a movie, take a shower, get a bite to eat before going hitting the rack. I rolled in on a 45 dive delivery, and incidentally, when you're flying at night, at least back in those days, you obviously have your lights off, and you can't see each other either. So you talk to each other and keep tabs. Try to keep quite a bit of separation for obvious reasons. So I'm not sure if he was facing away or facing toward me. I rolled in and I pulled off, and I rolled over to evaluate my hit so I could report it to the ship when I got back. When I got the bomb was going off on the trucks, and I got an indication in the cockpit of it being painted by the Fansong. I got the warble. I got the SAM alert light, and then it changed to the warble. And then I looked off to the distance and the direction that it was pointing to, and I could see about 10 miles away a big fireball arcing up to the dark sky and coming toward me. And I tell people, remind them that at night the human eye doesn't have very good depth perception, and if I turn too soon, it would give the SAM, it's coming up now three times the speed of sound, an opportunity to arc with me. And if I waited too late to do it, it had a 500-foot kill radius, and so I might have been caught in that radius. And I was pumping shaft to confuse the radar, but when I saw this fireball just kept coming up at me, I could see a dark center in the middle of the fireball, which was the nose cone. I figured it's time to break. So I did break, and I could feel it screaming by me, missing me. But what I didn't know is they fired another SAM from behind, and my ECM gear that it was making the noises was going to give you just one indication if it's one or more, and I didn't know about it. And it blew up next to me, and it took off my left wing. The plane immediately went into a nose down, falling. I realized I got to get out, and we have a face curtain we pull down. And that's the preferred method because it straightens your back and it protects your face. Or if you're real, got to get out now and can't take your hands off the controls, you just pull the D-ring that's between your legs. I pulled it, and it seemed like forever, as nothing happened. Well, it was my state of mind, because in 0.2 seconds, the system sequence started, the canopy blew, and I started going up the rails. But what happened in my mind is I looked down to see if it hung up on my entered blackout suit on my G suit, and then the seat fired. And so I didn't realize it at the time, but they gave me a double break up compression fracture of the neck when I went out. As I left, all I remember is a sudden rush of air, the red instrument lights pulling away. Then a second or two later, the plane blowing up, and I went horizontally over the, not, you know, right at the edge of the fireball, swung twice, and landed at a big, hard landing, but I landed and didn't break anything.
Just one quick question there. You said something I want to zoom in on here. Right after you ejected, the plane blew up. So if you had waited another second or two to pull that D-ring, you wouldn't be here?
I wouldn't be there. Even if I got out, then I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat. I mean, they're tremendous seats, and the engineers that put them and design them together and put them together do a tremendous job, but they got their limits. You got to give it a little bit of a opportunity for it to get you out. And a guy my size, 185 pounds, 6'2", is probably 200 feet, 250 feet. It blows you up if you're just sitting on the ground. So it's a pretty good kick in the seat. And then you got air bladders that push you away from the mechanical metal seat as you come out, and then your parachute opens if you're below 13,500 feet automatically. You try to beat it in case there's a malfunction, but it happens so fast. They're miracles, those seats. They get you out.
What was your estimated altitude when you ejected?
Well, all I remember seeing 2,000 feet screaming through the altimeter, and that'd be 2,000 feet above sea level. I have no idea about how high off the ground. I'm guessing it might be anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred feet, the elevation of the ground. There wasn't any mountains below me. It was all open rice paddies and fields. So I was probably around a little less than 2,000 feet above the ground when I got out, but things happen so fast.
And that's less than ideal.
Less than ideal. I actually, looking back, I thought I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat.
And so you said you swung twice and hit the ground.
I hit the ground on a swing and knocked the wind out of myself. I don't remember getting out of my parachute, my helmet, or the seat pan. That's the survival pan that stays with you after you separate from the metal seat. And I just remember running. The fireball was right there, so it was cooking off the 200 millimeter. My two machine guns were popping off. I was afraid of any of the surviving 500-pound bombs that go off, which got a 3,000-foot kill radius, so I had to get away from those. And then also the light of it was just giving me away. And as I ran, I have no idea how far I went. I got down behind a little clump of what I refer to as razor grass. It was real sharp grass, about 2-3 feet high, and squatted in it and just sort of tried to assess the situation. There was literally 100, if not more, North Vietnamese coming out of the village just screaming and yelling. And I have no idea how many were the paramilitia, how many were villagers, and a lot of the villagers were armed anyway, and how many were the soldiers. But they were all over the place in the open fields. But it was very, very dark. Another miracle for me. And I got behind this little clump of grass and tried to assess the situation. I put mud on my hands and face to cut the skin tones, and also the mosquitoes were terrible. I remember I thought I saw flashlights coming, and one flashlight would be over with. But there were fireflies, big fireflies up close that I was thinking might be lights in the distance. And talk about a relief. So I finally got one of my two radios out of my flight gear and called up Art, who was overhead. Of course, he knew from when you eject, you send a beeper coming off your seat. It goes on every radio frequency. It tells him that I got out, but it doesn't tell him if I made it out or if I'm killed on the ground or whatever. And I told him I was alive. And I had literally people 6 feet and look, stop and look right at me, and I'm in the open, and they wouldn't see me. Anyway, when I had a chance, when they move around looking, I called him up and told him I was alive. He said that Lieutenant Commander Bernie Smith, who was our ops officer, was another tremendous pilot, was inbound to help him. So Bernie, I could hear him on the radio calling me on my little handheld radio, but he could only hear static when I called back. So he said, "Jim, Mike, key me in. Left, two, right, one." And well, he had his lights on, and he's flying low and very fast, and everybody was shooting at him. I was really surprised. Not only there were more people there than I thought, but there were also, seemed like everybody had some kind of a firearm. And they were shooting at him, and I mic'd it, keyed him in, and then when he was overhead, I told him, "Okay, you're overhead now." And he was either being painted by radar from a destroyer or one of the E-2 surveillance planes that we had flying over the Gulf, or the South China Sea. They never went overland. He told them, and they're watching him, so they had a rough idea where I was. We didn't have any of the fancy gear we have today with GPS, the satellite imagery, and any of that kind of stuff. And then I told him to turn his lights off. I didn't want any company down there. They told me that a helicopter was coming in. And I looked around. I wanted to get out of there so bad. I was emotionally a wreck. But I told him, I said, there's no way a slow mover is going to survive this. And so I said, turn them back. I'll have to call it went in later. I got to move. I was going through shock. You know, 1 minute I'm flying an airplane. It was comfortable cockpit, familiar cockpit, a shower and an hour and a half away. And now I'm in the enemy's backyard. I was 150 miles north of DMZ, 21 miles in from the coast, in an area I was told when I got back that no Americans were ever seen again that went down that area. Wide open spaces and people all around.
A seemingly impossible situation for that downed pilot, Jim Lloyd, as it was for that helicopter tasked with trying to rescue him. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come, and there's a lot of information available for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.